Morning is finishing up our series about comforting. Let's remember how we got here. A few weeks ago, we talked about the process of sanctification and came to the realization that we bear fruit of sanctification through suffering. It's the tree of suffering upon which we bear fruit. What then we've done the last few weeks is look at how do we make it through suffering. We're going to change our focus next week, but very briefly, this is where we are. 2 weeks ago, we understood that God will give us more than we can bear, so we should trust His grace. That is, in my opinion, the biggest misnomer about suffering and the biblical view of it. God does give us more than we can handle, and so therefore we have to trust His grace. Last week, then, we looked at how can we comfort others. And we concluded that we should comfort through sympathizing, not minimizing what other people are going through. So rather than saying things like, it's just all going to be okay, it could be worse, it's not that bad, seeking to show sympathy. I may not understand what you're going through, but I'm here for you. I love you. I'm praying for you. God will give you more grace. Many good things we can say, but also many bad ones as well. Here's my question I would like to close with this morning. How does God provide comfort? All that we can do is point people to God's grace. But then whenever people get to God's grace, what then does it do in reference to our suffering? To answer this question, we are first going to look at a case study of Elijah. And then we're going to go to some other texts dealing with the suffering of Israel to really understand the complicated process through which God comforts. So if you look at the burdens of Elijah in 1 Kings 19, I'm going to skip around a little bit. We're not going to read all of this chapter, but let's begin in verse 1. 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 1. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one who was of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid, and he arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey in the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers." Elijah is in the pits of depression. Elijah has just had the climax of his successes by defeating the prophets of Baal. And after killing the prophets of Baal, Jezebel seeks revenge upon him. And this then plunges Elijah into a literal depression. He is so dark and so deep in agony at this point that he wants nothing else but to die. How does God deal with him? Continue in verse 4. He says, "It is enough now, O Lord. Take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers." And he lay down and slept under a broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." And he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God. I think what's interesting to note about this is the first thing that God does not do is minimize Elijah's suffering. And this piggybacks on what we talked about last week. God very easily could have said, "Elijah, you have seen my great works. You have seen my might. You have seen my power. And you are going to allow some anxiety to get to you. You're going to go into a depression because of what you're going through. It could be a whole lot worse. You could have been one of the prophets who was killed." That's not what God says. God does not minimize his suffering at all. He knows that what Elijah is going through is to him a burden too much for him to bear. And so God sends an angel to him. And what does the angel do? He makes him something to eat. Metaphorically, he sits in the ashes with him and says, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." So he sows sympathy. And brethren, I would recommend In this story, we need to be the angel. Yes, our suffering is individually going to take us to pits and darkness and questions that we must wrestle with in our relationship with God. But all that we're able to do for our brothers and sisters is simply to sit in the ashes, to make them something to eat, to show sympathy. That's what we're called to do. To be the love, to show the love of Christ and pour it out upon the world, and to demonstrate them the sympathy that should come from the very heart of God. But that's not where the story ends. Elijah is going to continue in this state for over a month, but God is going to give meaning to what he's going through. If you'll pick up in verse 9, there came to a cave and he lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him and said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" In the next few verses, there's going to be a situation and a conversation occur between God and Elijah. Pick up in verse 14. Elijah said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." The Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphath of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. And the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death. And the one who escapes the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." God is going to give meaning to the suffering of Elijah. Rather than just saying, "Elijah, eat, get strength, and trust me," he is going to provide for him an answer. Elijah is wondering, "Why am I the only one left? It feels as though I am the only one left in all of Israel, and there's no other faithful one who's left." God is going to tell him, "No, Elijah, there's an answer for what you're going through. You shall anoint kings. You shall anoint a prophet to take your place. They shall bring justice, and then you shall see there are 7,000 who will be left who have not bowed to Baal. You are not alone left, but I will give meaning to what you're going through." What's interesting to note is this. God could have told Elijah this 40 days ago. Why didn't he? Why didn't God just come down upon Elijah's first sense of anxiety and say, "Elijah, it's going to be okay. There are 7,000 who are left." That's not what God did. God allowed Elijah to suffer for over a month before he gives him the meaning and the solution and the way out of his suffering. I would recommend again what God does. Rather than minimizing our suffering, God is going to give meaning to it. But here's what we learn about Elijah. For us to understand the way out of our suffering, for us to understand the meaning of our suffering, we first have to go through that suffering. God is not going to make it easy for us. God is going to make his children go through the difficulties of life. We are going to have to go through times of anxiety, of depression, of suffering, of difficulty before we understand what that meaning is. But the question I would like to pose then is, what is the meaning of our suffering? Elijah's meaning was he had to suffer so that then there could be 7,000 found left faithful. What is the meaning of our suffering? Well, to understand the nature of suffering, we have to understand the nature of God's test. A question was posed to me after my lesson last Sunday morning, and it was a really, really good question. "Ryan, I thought God allowed us to be suffering. I thought God just allowed us to suffer. God never causes suffering. He allows us to suffer." That, I think, is a very common idea. That simply from the time of Eden on, it has been the natural byproduct of sin that has caused suffering and testing. The problem with that is that's not a biblical conclusion. I'm going to argue, and I'll show you many verses to support this claim. God does not just allow suffering, but He actively tests His children. Let's look at Exodus chapter 15 together. Exodus chapter 15. Again, for us to understand the meaning of our suffering, we have to look to see what is the nature of God's testing. What is a test to God is suffering to man. Exodus 15, verse 25. This is the story of the log being thrown in the water. He cried to the Lord. Moses cried to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a log. And he threw it in the water, and the water became sweet. There the Lord made for them a statute and a rule, and he tested them, saying, if you will diligently listen to the voice of the Lord your God and do that which is right in his eyes and give ear to his commandments and keep his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you that I put upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord your healer. God does not just allow suffering. He actively tests, which then causes suffering. That's a difficult realization for us to make. I don't know where this idea has come from, that God simply allows suffering but never actively tests us. Throughout biblical texts, from Genesis to Revelation, God is actively testing. He is causing what we call suffering. God is active in this. Notice here what God says. Verse 25, God tested them. And then verse 26, God said, I will put none of the diseases on you that I will put upon that I have put upon the Egyptians. What's the conclusion? God caused suffering upon the Egyptians. And God may cause suffering upon Israel if they don't listen to Him. God actively tests. The recommendation I would give is we have to stop seeing God as a heavenly bystander. So often I think our view of God is that He's just a bystander. You know what bystander effect is? A bystander is someone who sees wrong going on and assumes that other people are going to take care of it, but they never actively have to get involved. God is not just some heavenly bystander. God is the active, providential God whose hand is always at work in this world. God actively is testing. God actively has and perhaps is causing suffering. It's a difficult, difficult, difficult realization of God. But if we want to see the biblical God for who He really is, we must understand He does not just allow suffering, but He actively causes testing. Where did this idea come from? I have a couple of guesses. The first is in Job 1. We aren't going to take the time to turn there. But in Job chapter 1, there is this discourse between God and Satan. And Satan says, let me test him. God says, fine, I'll allow it. If you just read that situation in its individual context, you would assume, yes, God simply allows suffering. The problem with that is, if you go through Job 38 through 42, God makes the case, I'm sovereign. I am the one who's active. I am the one in control. Deal with it, Job. So no, not even in the book of Job does God simply allow suffering. Also in James chapter 1, let no man say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and He Himself tempts no one. But each one is carried away and enticed by his own lust. That verse is not saying that God has never tested. What that verse is saying is, God is not enticed by evil, and He will never entice you with evil. You are enticed by evil by your own lust. But yes, God tests. God causes suffering. Go with me, please, to Psalm chapter 66. Psalm chapter 66. I'm not going to take the time to read Exodus and Judges and Psalms and Proverbs and Jeremiah. This is a very small sampling of passages that demonstrate God tests and by that consequent causes suffering. Look at Psalm chapter 66, verse 10. For you, O God, have tested us You have tried us as silver is tried. You brought us into the net. You laid a crushing burden on our backs. You let men ride over our heads. We went through fire and through water. You have brought us out to a place of abundance. Notice here, God has tested, and then verse 11, you have laid a crushing burden on our backs. Often, and perhaps, the burdens that are too great for us to bear are put upon us by God Himself. God is testing. And in the midst of that testing, there's going to be suffering. There are going to be burdens too great for us to bear. But brethren, that is the biblical and one true God. Is not some passive God who simply allows suffering, but He is a God who actively tests His children. Well, why does He do it? Why does He do it? You may be thinking, well, Ryan, if this is the God of the Bible, this is not the God that I want to serve. And many have said that. As you go throughout biblical texts and you see example after example after example after example of God testing and causing suffering, you're then left to wonder, why would God do this? And this, of course, is the greatest question about Christianity and the greatest question about theism in general is the problem of evil. So many have left belief in God because how could a good God allow so much evil? Here's how the question goes. God is either all good or all powerful, but not both. If He's all good, He's not all powerful to allow all this to occur. And if He's all powerful, He can't be all good to allow all of this evil to occur. How then do you reconcile the very nature of God? Well, I would recommend there are biblical answers. They're difficult answers, but let's seek to understand what they are. So here's where we are. Let's summarize real quick. When it comes to our testing, what we need to do for each other is we need to show sympathy. Personally, we must look to God and find meaning in that suffering. To find meaning, we first must understand God is testing. Now let's ask the question, why does He test? Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy chapter 8. This is a difficult, difficult chapter. But I think many of the questions of suffering and evil are found in Deuteronomy chapter 8. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 1. Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 1. The whole commandment that I command you today, you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply, and go and possess the land that the Lord swore to give to your fathers. And you shall remember the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that He might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep His commandments or not. And He humbled you and let you hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that He might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. I'm going to offer two reasons that God allows testing and that God actively tests. These I do not claim to be an exhaustive understanding of testing, but they at least are to provide meaning in the midst of our testing. The first is in verse 2. God actively tests that He may know what is in our heart. Look at verse 2. Yahweh your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness that He might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep His commandments or not. God tested us to know what was in our heart. Now, I don't know about you, but that unsettles me a little bit. In our study of God in my home last year, we looked at various qualities of God, and one is God is all-knowing, He's all-wise, omniscient. If God is omniscient, why then does He need to know what is in our hearts. Doesn't he already know what's in our heart? Didn't he make our heart? Well, this is a difficult question. Some have taken this to mean that God is not all-knowing. I think that's an unbiblical concept to the nth degree. But in what sense does God want to know what's in our hearts? Well, let me provide you a solution. This may not be the solution, but it's at least a solution. Stay in Deuteronomy, but let's go to chapter 13. Look at chapter 13, verse 1. Again, this is a difficult, difficult passage to wrestle with. If a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or wonder, and the sign or wonder that he tells you comes to pass, and he says, let us go after other gods, which you've not known, and let us serve them. You shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God is testing you. That's a difficult passage. God was going to send false prophets among Israel to test them. That's not the nice little neat God that we like to think of, right? We like to think of God as just some predictable, understandable entity. But it reminds me of what Lewis said of Aslan. He's not a tame lion. God was going to send prophets among them to test them. Verse 3, the Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. God was going to test them to see whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. I would recommend God is not testing us to know what we can do. He's testing us to know what we will do. Why does a teacher give tests? Really, why does a teacher give tests? Is it for the sake of the teacher? Or is it for the sake of the student? The reason that I as a teacher give tests is to find out what my students will do. God already knows what we can do, but he wants to find out what we will do. And the reason then that God actively tests his children is for us to know what we will do. Back in Genesis chapter 22 verse 1, when Abraham had to go to Mount Moriah and offer Isaac, it tells us there that God was testing Abraham. Same word used in Hebrews 11, I believe it's verse 6 and 7, that God was testing Abraham. Why did God test Abraham? It wasn't because he did not know what Abraham could do, but rather it was to find out what Abraham would do. The reason that God sends us tests is to discover for ourselves what we will do. And brethren, when we approach tests, we have to ask ourselves, what will we do? Why did God allow Elijah to go over a month in the midst of his agony? Why did God allow Elijah to suffer? Why did he allow Elijah to go to the pits of depression? Why didn't he just tell him the truth at the very beginning of that journey? Because he needed to know what Elijah would do. Elijah was going to have to appoint a successor. And he needed to know, Elijah, how committed to me are you? Elijah, how faithful are you to me? Elijah, how faithful are you in every precept and every command to my way? God was testing Elijah to know what was in his heart. And brethren, when we are tested, it's not to find out what's in our mind. It's not just to find out what we know. It's to find out what's in our heart. It's to find out where our loyalties lie. It's to find out how strong our faith is. It's to discover how much our heart is really hidden in God. That is why God tests us. Reason number two, let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 8. So the first reason is God tests us to learn what's in our heart. Reason number two, Deuteronomy chapter 8 verse 11. Deuteronomy chapter 8 verse 11. Take care lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his rules and his statutes which I command you today. Lest when you've eaten and are full and have built good houses to live in them, and when you have your herds and flocks multiply and your silver and gold is multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart will be lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, who led you through the great and terrifying wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground there was no water, who brought you water out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna that your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and test you to do you good in the end. The second reason, and this is a difficult one to accept, God tests us to do us good in the end. Boy, that's a hard one to accept, isn't it? Our all-good God knows what we need. Our all-knowing God knows how to give it to us. And so often in this life, the ultimate goodness, the eternal goodness that God is seeking in us is going to require testing. And the reason that God tests us is to do us good in the end. So again, God does us good to know what's in our heart, to do us good in the end. But that's difficult to accept, isn't it? Because wouldn't it be a whole lot easier to believe in a God who never causes suffering? Wouldn't it be easier to be in a God who never, to believe in a God who never tests? Wouldn't it be easy to believe in a God who just gives out riches and wealth and prosperity and happiness and joy without any testing to get there? That's not the biblical God. That's not the true God. The true God is one who makes it far more difficult. He is one who requires testing and endurance on the part of his children before we have that eternal reward. I want us to turn together to Isaiah chapter 48. Isaiah chapter 48. Going back to Elijah, why did God test Elijah? Well, it was to do him good in the end. Because after those 40 days, Elijah's faith was much stronger than it had been. And when then he needed to anoint kings, when he needed to anoint a successor, it was going to be according to the full strength of his faith and not according to the weak, faltering of belief that he was left with after facing the prophets of Baal. The reason then that Elijah had to suffer was for his faith to grow. And it refined him. Isaiah chapter 48 verse 10. I love this verse. Behold, God says, I have refined you, but not as silver. I have tried you in the furnace of affliction. Brethren, in our lives, God is going to put us in the furnace. He is going to test us. Why does he do it? It's not because he's vindictive. It's not because he's evil. It's not because he's a mean, angry God, but it's because he's an all-good God who knows this is a world inflicted with sin. And to get out the love of this world from us, God is going to have to refine us. Ever since Adam and Eve ate of the fruit of the garden, we have lived in a fallen world, a world that needs refinement. And God then is going to put us in the furnace of affliction. He's going to try and he's going to test us so that he's going to do us good in the end. Now, brethren, that's a difficult concept for us to understand. But I would urge every single one of us, when we are in the midst of affliction, why are we going through this? What do I need to learn from this? Now, don't misunderstand me. I do not believe that every last bit of suffering that comes upon us is from the hand of God. If you go to Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and Ecclesiastes chapter 9, time and chance happen to all. It very well could be that it's just circumstances of life that we are caught up in. It could be that God is punishing us for something. It could be that we're suffering for no other reason alone, that chance is occurring to us. Or it could be that our God is testing us and refining us to humble us to know what's in our very hearts. What do I need to learn in the midst of my suffering? What is the meaning that I am going to glean in the midst of my suffering? Depression, anxiety, sadness, suffering, it's very easy for us to turn inward. It's very easy for us just to look inward and ask, well, how am I going to get through this? Brethren, that's not the question we need to ask. The question we need to ask is, what grace is my God showing to me? What refinement is God showing me? Let me ask you this. When you look at the fruit of the Spirit in Ephesians, Galatians chapter 5 rather, gentleness and love and self-control, those are going to be born through suffering. Had you preferred to stand before God on the day of judgment with sin and flaws on your soul that are going to separate you from Him for eternity? Or would you prefer the refinement and suffering of this life to burn them out of you now? That's what James 1 says. Consider it all joy, my brothers, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Why then must we as God's people go through lives of suffering and trial and testing? It's to refine us for the day of judgment. When you look at 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, why is our faith refined? It's so that our faith can be brought full in the grace of God. So that when we stand before God on the day of judgment, we will say, God, it is not by my own might that I will enter in. Because you know what? It was not by my might that I made it through the first life. It was by your grace. I trusted you. I had faith in you. And that brought me through this first life. And God, it is only going to be by your grace. And it's going to be by my faith in your grace that then I will enter into the heavenfold for all of eternity. That is a difficult, difficult, difficult view of life. Because, brethren, what is the popular view of the gospel today? One of ease and wealth and pleasure and happiness. But brethren, that has never been God's plan for His people. Just as God tested His children for 40 days in the wilderness, just as God tested Elijah for 40 days on his way to Horeb, God will, for perhaps 40 or more years of our life, test us to refine us, to humble us, to know what's in our hearts, to know what we will do. And praise be to Him that through that testing, we will bear fruit. Go with me to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. I would like to close this series by finishing where we started. Sanctification. Sanctification is born on the tree of suffering. We get through that suffering by trusting in His grace, by comforting one another, and by looking to the meaning of suffering that God gives us in life. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 11. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. What is God going to do? God does not leave us in the midst of our testing alone, but that testing will produce within us the peaceful fruit of righteousness, the fruit of sanctification. I would ask you, in the midst of your own testing, what fruit have you borne? Have you borne gentleness and peace and love and grace and faith? Or have you failed that testing? You've become conceited, arrogant, angry, vengeful, prideful. No, life is not easy, and never was it meant to be. But it is only when we see the meaning of suffering in the light of our God that we have any chance to get through it. So let's then answer our question. How does God comfort us? God gives meaning to our suffering as it brings us closer to His grace and refines our spirit. No, it's not an easy sermon to preach. And it's even more difficult to live. But that is how our God comforts us in the midst of our testing. Get out your songbooks, please. There's a very critical part of suffering that I've left out of the sermon so far. You know what it is? The cross. The principles that I've indicated so far have been from an Old Testament perspective. But I think if you go back and you read Deuteronomy chapter 8, in light of the cross, those principles come to all the much more spiritual fulfillment. And actually, if you want to find even a bit more digging, we began this series by going to 1 Corinthians 10. 1 Corinthians 10 draws from Deuteronomy chapter 8. The testing that God has given to His people has never changed. But God tested His own Son. That's what Hebrews 3 and Hebrews 4 and Hebrews 5 tells us. That Jesus, in the days of His flesh, offered up prayers and supplications to Him who was able to save Him from death. Hebrews 5, 7. What God has done is God tested His Son to find out what was in His heart and to do good in the end. And what's interesting is, as you look at all of the testing that has gone on, there is only one example where we've actually found out what the conclusion is. Think through this just a second with me. Whenever you get a test, you wait for its results, right? You wait to see what the final grade is going to be. If you take a classroom analogy, in the testing of this world, God has given the grade to many people on the individual test. But the final grade at the end of the class, it's only been given under one circumstance. 1 Corinthians 15, in the new man Jesus Christ. For the rest of us, we're waiting for the class to finish. Yes, we've gotten through pop quizzes. We've gotten through tests. We've gotten through trials. But we're still waiting for that class to finish. We're waiting for the final chapter to be written. The only example of that finality of the class, the finality of testing, has come through Jesus Christ. And how did it finish in Him? You remember in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, after Jesus was tested, after He was killed at the hand of sinners, what did God do? He arose Him and He gave Him a new life. He gave Him a new flesh, a new spirit. And everything of this life had refined Him to where God put upon Him the perfect body for all of eternity. That's what we're waiting for. But brethren, for us to get there, we're going to have to be refined. God's going to have to find out what's in our hearts. And then on the day of eternity, when the dead in Christ raise first, and then all the dead arise, and every knee bows at the knee of Jesus Christ, then after that eternal refinement, God will then give the final grade, the grade of success, the grade of passing to all who've trusted in Him. No, it's not easy to get there, but that's the call of the gospel message. It's through the cross. And let us always look to the cross of Christ in the midst of suffering. Let us always look to our God in the midst of trial. Let us always look to the comfort of His Word in the midst of affliction. The last 3 weeks, we've talked about mainly the aspects of emotional suffering that we've gone through. But there's, of course, a spiritual suffering that entails every single one of us. As Andy drew out for us on Wednesday night, in looking at Jairus' daughter and the woman with the excrement of blood, here was two individuals who had physical ailments, but it was just symbolic of their spiritual ailments within us. When we look at Elijah and we look at his emotional suffering, it is only symbolic of the spiritual suffering that we go through. It's only through Christ. It's only through the cross. It's only through faith in Him that we come to Him. If you need to come to Him this very morning, come forward while we stand and sing.